Welcome to Surgical Hot Topics, a podcast series from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. This podcast features leaders in cardiothoracic surgery discussing timely issues important to the profession and their patients. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual participants and not necessarily that of STS.
Welcome to a roundtable discussion on recognizing and treating the frail patient. We have a panel with us here. I'm Mark Ferguson, the moderator. I'm a thoracic surgeon at the University of Chicago.
My name is Betty Tong. I'm a general thoracic surgeon at Duke University Medical Center.
I'm Linda Martin. I'm a thoracic surgeon at the University of Virginia.
My name is Nimesh Desai, and I'm a cardiac surgeon at the University of Pennsylvania.
So this is a burgeoning topic in the last 5 years or so, and a lot of subspecialty areas are interested in it. We have a number of points to go over today that our panelists are experts on, and so I think we'll start with the definition of frailty. Linda, you want to take that?
Sure. So there's a number of different publications that have looked at frailty and how to define it. In our world of general thoracic surgery, it's tempting to use things like the ECOG performance status, and there are some crossovers and similarities, but it is not quite the same thing. And also that allows it to be translated to other fields such as cardiac surgery, general surgery. And there's a number of scoring systems that have been described, one of which is the acronym FRAIL. There's another Hopkins frailty score that's out there. Essentially, these scoring systems all look at things like weight loss more than 5% over a period of a few months, grip strength, their get up and go, how fast it takes them to get from a seated to a standing position, or some look simply at how far they travel. The patient travels in a period of 15, or how long it takes them to go 15 feet, something along those lines. And you can think of it as going from the chair to the exam table. Can they do it on their own? So we talked about weight loss. Hemoglobin is measured in some, but some of them are purely clinical assessments. Have they fallen recently? So things along those lines that just tell you that they're not a robust patient.
So some would define frailty as an increased vulnerability to physiologic stressors. Are there any examples of that sort of reaction or behavior in patients that you look for?
Vulnerability, I guess, again, it's the patients you think aren't going to weather the storm of an operation well, or if they have any setbacks in their recovery, they won't pull through it. Their resilience, they don't have the resilience, I think, that we're looking for. And it can be tricky, and I would say, as a cancer surgeon, it sometimes is hard to look past that and try to think of what's going to be best for the patient versus being able to offer something curative, and I find that I'm very conflicted about that in the clinic.
Mesh, what do you have to add?
So frailty assessments become something really important in cardiac surgery when TAVR became a clinical reality, that we started doing a formal frailty assessment in all our patients as part of the original pivotal trials that got the TAVR devices approved. And so I think that culture has really weaved its way into thinking about how our patients are going to do after surgery. You know, if you look at the data on frailty and what that means for the patient, if you're intermediate frail, the risk of a major complication is twice as high or three times as high. If you're really frail, it might be 20 times higher risk of ending up in a nursing home after surgery. So these are things, you know, that are really important to us, and especially when people are monitoring our outcomes and looking at risk scores and things like that. Understanding frailty is actually a really important part of understanding risk. I think that when we all have intuition. You see a patient, you know that there's something about them that looks like they're not going to recover well from the surgery, but some of the scales that we were just alluding to, I think, are really important. And we've tried to build some of that into our electronic medical record as just sort of the introductory part when they come in, and either the nurse or nurse practitioner or the physician will actually go through a lot of those things with them as part of our initial risk stratification, you know, what their mobility is like, have they had weight loss, all these other things that we've talked about, their ADLs. And so I think they're really important in risk stratifying. And we do pick up people who we would not have really thought of as frail otherwise just by using those routinely.
I wonder if you could comment, since you've had a fair amount of experience in formal assessment of frailty, whether you measure sarcopenia or look into dementia as other parameters of this syndrome.
So sarcopenia is an interesting area. Obviously, that's the loss of muscle mass and muscle strength that happens often with aging. There was a lot of interest when we started doing TAVR and actually using the CAT scan to look at people's psoas muscle thickness or volume, I think it was. I don't think anything really came of that. Grip strength is a fundamental part of the frailty assessment we do in almost, well, in every TAVR patient, but more and more in our regular open surgical practice as well. It's interesting because the grip device, I mean, I can barely do it, but that means I need to go to the gym more often. But it is an area where you can really quickly pick up a patient who is frail or has loss of muscle mass or sarcopenia that you wouldn't necessarily notice just looking at them when they're clothed and come sort of more dressed up to go to the doctor's office. Mm-hmm.
Betty, I wonder if you could comment on some of the consequences of frailty that you've seen in your practice in thoracic surgery.
I think there's no doubt that frailty affects both short-term and long-term outcomes after surgery. When we talk about weathering the storm of either cardiac surgery or general thoracic surgery, there have been several studies demonstrating that frailty affects post-operative morbidity as well as mortality. In terms of morbidity, there have been studies looking at length of stay, readmission, discharge to home versus facility, and patients who are more frail all have higher rates of those complications. Also in terms of mortality, both on the cardiac side as well as the general thoracic side, as cancer surgeons, we tend to think about long-term survival as well as the post-operative mortality. Those are all affected by frailty indices. As a couple of examples, there was a recent paper by the Michigan State Quality Initiative looking at outcomes after cardiac surgery. They looked at gait speed in their cardiac surgery patients, and those patients with a slower gait speed compared to less frail patients with a higher gait speed had a higher incidence of postoperative complications. Nimesh, you talked about the formal assessment of frailty in TAVR patients. There was a meta-analysis looking at TAVR patients, and even those who got TAVR and who were more frail had a higher incidence of complications. So I think that's burgeoning and becoming much better described, certainly within our world. On the general thoracic side, looking at lung cancer patients, sarcopenia has been examined in non-small cell lung cancer patients. There was a recent paper by a Japanese group looking at that on the preoperative CT scans. And again, major complication around the time of surgery, perioperative complications increased, but also long-term survival decreased or was decreased in the frail population compared to the non-frail population. So I think it's something that we all need to be very aware of and should learn to assess for both informally as well as formally.
Speaking of which, Linda, at your institution, are you formally assessing for frailty in many patients or highly select patients?
Not formally. So of course we talk about any more complex patients we talk about in the tumor board setting and talk about if this patient doesn't seem like a great surgical candidate, are there alternatives that are reasonable? Whether it's SBRT for a stage one lesion or if it's a little bit more involved, is it something we would use chemo and radiation? And interestingly, some of these patients we're reluctant to operate on, our oncology colleagues don't actually want to give them chemo or concurrent chemo radiation either. And then you're stuck with sort of like, well, gosh, what do we do for this patient's cancer? I think about it more. I think some of the work that you've done, Mark, has brought my attention to it, and I pay attention to how they move in the room and how they get across from point A to point B. And there's times where they might have actually really good PFTs, there's nothing explicit in terms of cardiovascular risk, but you just have that gestalt that they're not going to do well with surgery. I guess the thing I struggle with more is we can sub-select out patients to have the best possible results and have our morbidity and mortality rates look better than everybody else's in the country. But at the end of the day, what do we do for those patients that still need something done for their disease, whether it's their valves or their lung cancer? So again, we can decide we're only going to operate on the cream of the crop, but then what do we do with those people that are in the middle that could kind of go either way? And is there room to improve their status so that we can offer them curative, life-extending treatments? And I think that's really where the struggle lies.
Well, so Nimesh, that sort of opens the door to shared decision-making conversations. How do you manage that in your practice?
Yeah, so it's, again, so important to recognize the problem first. And then, you know, having the real frank discussion with the patient. More and more we're working within a multidisciplinary team, so we can all bring different aspects of care options to the patient, which, again, was probably more common in sort of a tumor board setting than in the cardiac surgery setting for a long time. But I think the heart team concept has really opened up so many avenues for us to optimize the care of the patients. When we're looking at that frail patient and trying to understand what are the potential ways that we can get them to some kind of treatment, you know, you start off with, well, can we improve their frailty, right? That's, I think, sort of the first thing that we're looking at is, can we get them to a geriatrician to get a more comprehensive assessment, maybe deal with some of the polypharmacy issues, understand their cognitive abilities better. Physiotherapists, very important to get, you know, to increase muscle mass, to do some resistance training, that kind of thing. And then nutrition is the other side. I mean, I think these are things that we can influence pretty well in patients who have the reserve to get through those interventions, and then take a look at them again, see if they're a candidate for the surgery or not. And if that's not possible, then we start talking about, okay, well, is there a catheter-based solution for this problem, even if it may not address all of the problems that the patient has to try and improve their quality of life? Can we do it with a minimally invasive option instead of going through a full sternotomy incision where the recovery might be a little bit faster? Can we optimize the perioperative management using ERAS protocols and things to alter the amount of anesthetic a patient gets to wake them up, you know, earlier after surgery and immobilize them earlier? I think these are all things we're working towards.
That's a real, the latter is a real sea change for cardiac surgery practices. So Betty, I wonder if you could go into a little bit more depth about some of the ways to mitigate pre-frailty or frailty and how that might influence outcomes.
Oh, I think certainly the first thing to do to mitigate is to screen for it and recognize it in our patient population. So I think it was your group, Mark, who looked at what proportion of patients referred to a general thoracic clinic were actually pre-frail or frail, and I think it was up to 70%. So it's not an insignificant population of folks. I think once we recognize that patients are either frail or pre-frail, first, as you mentioned, Nimesh, to get a geriatrician on board and do a comprehensive geriatric assessment. I'm a big fan of loading the boat in that regard and helping not only the other clinicians, but having the patient and their family really engaged to help get them in shape for surgery. Aside from that, we talk a lot in our clinics about doing prehab. It's often that there's a week or two between when I see them in the clinic and when their surgical date is. So we talk a lot about walking, vigorous walking and exercise. You, I think, in some of your work have looked at strength training as well in terms of improving these frailty indices and nutrition assessment. So we talk a lot about walking and optimizing their conditions as much as they can before surgery and doing it every day. Certainly many patients in my practice, as well as certainly their family members, have a smartphone. And you can help them utilize their smartphone app to track how far they've walked. I had one woman who was walking 100 steps a day before surgery, and we talked about it. She said, well, I don't carry my phone everywhere. I said, okay, well, pick up your phone, make sure it goes with you wherever you go. And she came back, she was walking a mile a day. And those small sorts of interventions, I think, really can add up to help the patients as they get ready for surgery.
So Betty, I have a question for you. You know, I think in some circumstances we have the luxury of time to send them to a geriatrician and really step up their nutrition, but we all know that's not an overnight fix. Right. And we have the occasional patients, say they have benign disease or they have a small nodule, and you have some time, or you've got a patient with aortic valve disease that they've had for a long time, but we also all deal with patients who really are more urgent. They're not emergent, but they're urgent, and I think that's where it gets challenging. And one thought is just to at least risk stratify so that we can have realistic conversations, but realize we're not going to be able to prehab them.
It's finding the optimal window,
yeah.
Really, to intervene. And nobody wants to wait on cancer, certainly not the patients. But I think sometimes there's benefit to even 1 or 2 weeks will make a difference. And I think really the key is getting the patient engaged and helping them to see that doing the work before surgery will help make it easier for them afterward.
It's a controversial area. The data are mixed, but what's your personal limit to permit prehab results before surgery?
I suppose I've used this most in the context of smoking cessation. And I try for 4 weeks of smoking cessation, which you could extend to include that's a facet of prehab. And you could be doing those other interventions during that time, but there's times where I feel sort of pressured to do it within a couple of weeks, and some of it's based on the stage of the tumor, the local aggressiveness, are they having hemoptysis? But it's one of the many things I have sort of internal angst about when I'm in the clinic sorting things out with the patient of, you know, do I have to repeat their imaging because too much time has lagged between their workup and when I get them to the OR? Are they going to have to come for another office visit to redo their lab work? You know, something as practical as that. And it's just one of the multiple things we have to factor into our planning. And some of it sounds really great in the abstract, but in the everyday hustle and bustle of the clinic, it can be a challenge.
Yeah. Well, and we have many masters, right? Mm-hmm. We have quality initiatives that want us to do the cancer resection within 30 days of their diagnosis. So fitting all of the prehab that they need to have done before that 30-day window expires, if you will, can be very challenging. That's tough.
Great.
Yeah, I think there's on the cardiac side, there's also a lot of inpatient surgery that happens. Patients presenting with congestive heart failure, and then needing surgery really before they can go home and be rehabilitated or prehabilitated a little bit. And I think those patients are really at very high risk, and we've been trying to, on the inpatient setting also, just delay the surgery for a few days, just get them out of bed if we can, and get them walking with the physiotherapist, get some protein nutrition into them to try and optimize things. But I think that's a group of patients on the cardiac side that is really at risk, that we often don't take enough of an evaluation on in terms of frailty.
Well, I think it's been a very valuable discussion. We pointed out some new knowledge that hopefully in the not too distant future will become standard for evaluating and hopefully providing intervention options for patients undergoing major surgery. My thanks to the panel. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to Surgical Hot Topics. If you like this podcast, please rate it and let your friends and colleagues know about it. More information about the Society of Thoracic Surgeons is available online at sts.org and on our patient website, ctsurgerypatients.org.